Welcome to Camp Podcast Special Edition, Piano Talk. I'm pianist Migo, and I serve as president of the Contemporary Art Music Project, or CAMP. CAMP is an organization that promotes innovative art music and collaborates with composers and performing artists. One of many activities we do is our podcast series. Our hosts explore a wide range of topics from marginalized composers to current collaborations. Piano Talk brings you new piano repertoire and composers who wrote them. Tonight, I'm your host, and I am delighted to have composer John Liberatore. Hi, John. It is very exciting to talk about you and your music.
Hi, Inmi. It's nice to be here. Always enjoy talking with you.
Yeah. We can probably start with your background, how you started getting into music, if anybody influenced you in the past, anybody in your family played any instrument, and how you get into this business.
Sure, yeah. You know, I don't really come from a musical family, and I come from a pretty small town. So my background in music, I think, was very kind of exploratory. You know, didn't quite know where to look. But one person that could play the piano when we first got a piano in my house was my grandfather on my mother's side. And he would play the music of his generation, which was like Tin Pan Alley. But he had taken piano lessons, you know, back in the 1920s or something for about a year with an old teacher that would hit his hands with a ruler, that kind of thing. And he didn't really know how to read music. And he would be the first to tell you that he wasn't very good. But I can remember him very distinctly how he would play. He would sit down and he would kind of feel his way around these tunes that he knew. And, you know, show me the way to go home. He'd play something like, I can remember the way that he looked, the way that his hands looked as he kind of felt around the piano like he was playing this hymn or something. I didn't know until I was an adult that that tune actually goes. Right? But I always thought of it as like this contemplative piece or something, because he would sit down and play when he was waiting for me to get ready in the morning or something. He was going to take me out to breakfast. And he would do it just for his own enjoyment, just out of his curiosity. And what I really admired about it, and what took me a while to realize was special about it, was that the music just kind of came out of him. Like, he didn't really know how to read. He didn't have any repertoire, like, under his hands or anything. He didn't really have any technical ability at the piano. But he could just sit down and make music. And as soon as I started playing, I think that's really what I wanted to do. And still, I think a lot of what I try and do at the piano. I took piano lessons, you know, with people who were from my hometown. There was a woman I took lessons with for a while. Her name was Betsy Button. And she sounds like a fairy book character. And she kind of was. You know, she was just very ebullient of personality, and everything that I did for her was just fantastic. I could come in and play with my elbows, and she would tell me it was great. And I would, you know, fake my way through a passage, and she would say something like, well, the notes you played are way better than the ones that are on the page. So I didn't develop a lot of real rigorous pianistic discipline, but I did develop a real curiosity and love for it, and a sense that I could make something new with the piano. And really, from the beginning, that's what I thought it was for. So my first compositions you know, put scare quotes around it, were just kind of me noodling around at the piano and eventually improvising something more or less the same way a half a dozen times and calling it a composition. And I didn't have any idea how to write that down. I don't think that I actually wrote a piano piece, it was notated, until I was a doctoral student, honestly.
Wow.
Because there was 2010, I want to say. And it was terrible. It was a terrible piece. but it was it's so hard to make that connection to bridge, you know, what you can do with your hands with what you can put on the page and really bring those things together in a way that I think is genuine and articulate. That's something that I think I've really only kind of found a way into doing in the past dozen years or so.
Well, yeah, I didn't know about that, that you had not written anything on the score for piano until you were a doctor.
I wrote things with piano in it.
Right.
But like a solo piano piece. The closest I came, I put one on my senior recital when I was in college. But I didn't really play what I wrote. You know, I kind of approximated what I wanted to do and then faked my way through it.
Yeah. Well, but that's how Mozart used to play, how Chopin used to play,
true,
right?
Yeah. Chopin would probably be appalled to hear people read the score for
verbatim. Right, right. Yeah. So, yeah, with practice, yeah. But, I mean, I also, because I heard from composers who also are a pianist or their primary instrument is piano, that it's somewhat harder to compose piece for solo piano. And I have a few friends made that confession to me, and
well,
I was curious about that. You know, and also their composer, like Robert Helps, who wrote this like beautiful piano pieces, and he was really like pianist composer, you know, performed like professional pianist, and then he also wrote a lot of piano music.
Well, I use the example of like the guitar, because I've written some guitar pieces recently, and I don't really play the guitar except for, you know, I know where a G major chord is, that kind of thing. And, you know, it's such a difficult terrain to navigate the neck of the guitar if you don't really play it. And it's intimidating because there are all of these, you know, Villalobos and Fernando del Sor and all of these composers, especially Catalonian composers, who make the guitar just sound like an orchestra.
Mm.
And it sounds so wonderful and resonant. But there are so many subtleties and nuances that make those very specific things that they're doing possible. That like they allow certain notes to ring while others are stopped, and they know just when those ringing notes are going to cut off and all that kind of stuff. And even when you play the piano's a lot like that, because it has a much vaster repertoire, at least in the in classical music, but likewise of these composer piano giants like Chopin or Liszt or whatever, who would make the piano sound like a carnival and activate all the registers of the piano at once, and it's very intimidating. And on top of that, there are so many different repertoires for the piano that do that in different ways. You know, the Scarlatti sonatas play the instrument beautifully and with this kind of intimate knowledge of the instrument that's really hard to achieve with a very, very different texture than, you know, Rachmaninoff or something. So I think, you know, one thing that that one of my mentors, the composer Joe Kondo, said to me about writing for the piano, he said, "Well, which piano? What piano are you talking about?" Right? Because the piano can not only do so many things, but be so many things. And I think that This is probably true with every instrument, but maybe especially with the piano. When you first try to write something for it, you feel like it has to be your magnum opus or something, like it has to do all of the great things that a piano does. And so you have a piece that tries to put all those things together, that has big thundering passages and single note intimate passages and big warm chords and arpeggios and fast runs and like, who cares? But it's another thing, and this is, I think, what I really try to do, especially with the piano. It's one thing to create a whole avalanche of notes, but it's something else to try to make one note really special. And a lot of piano repertoire that I really love does that more than shower me with notes. Somehow I hear this note that I've heard a million times, and yet it sounds like it's never sounded before.
Yeah. Interesting. I mean, it's like you talk about this Chopin and Liszt and Rachmaninoff with a lot of notes that show the virtuosity of the performer, and that's those kind of music usually really impress audience and performers too. So there's that, I think, a lot of pressure probably to, maybe not all composers, but whoever wants to write for piano, I have to put more notes and there has to be more and more and more. Yeah. But I also had that pressure even as a performer, that I had to be this kind of flash pianist that can show how fast I can do things and how loud I can be and how exciting I can make this music, and which I felt I'm not always that kind of performer. And it took me actually for a while to accept that. And it's okay not to always be like flashy, not to always be fast and not always be loud. It's okay to be in the other side.
Yeah. But you have a recording you released that has the second book of my line drawings on.
Yeah.
The third one.
Yeah.
The third one is the one that I can play. It's not virtuosic at all, but it takes, I don't know, there's something about when I play it, I can play the notes, but when you play it, it comes to life in a way that there's an incredible virtuosity to the way that you play that piece.
Oh, thank you.
That's not, and it's not, virtuosity is in the ear. It's not in the hands.
Oh, it's true.
At least real virtuosity. And just playing a chord and getting it to sound together, but voicing it just right. Or playing a single note line that doesn't let up, that carries forward, that carries you along with it. These are incredibly virtuosic things.
Yeah. Well, maybe that's why I like your music. Well, that's why I like your pieces so much. And we had, this common loving towards Chopin. And, you just sent me this recording of your playing of Fanny Mendelssohn's Lieder for Piano, Opus 6, number 1.
Ah, well, here, I'll try and play it and see if it sounds any better. Sorry if I put this up in front of you here. Thank you. I'll just play the beginning.
Yeah. It's a beautiful piece.
It is. And this is the kind of example of what I'm talking about here. I'm still kind of reading it. I'm just, you know, picking this piece up and really trying to get to know it. Of course, I've played a lot of her brother's songs without words.
Right.
Kind of standard repertoire. Mm-hmm. And I really love those pieces. I think they're kind of underappreciated as romantic leader. Mm-hmm. And there are some things that remind me kind of the texture, like here's Felix's Opus 33 number, what is it, 33? No, it's book 4, number 1. It's a very beautiful song. I mean, it's really, and there's a kind of classical lyricism to it that kind of fits in this space between the romantic lead of Schubert and a kind of Mozartian classicism or something like that. But with Fanny's song here, it has that same kind of lyricism, but it somehow weaves through this incredibly restless harmonic language, mm-hmm. this kind of searching harmony that never quite goes where you expect it to. And so the line always moves forward, like the melody by itself. Now it comes to rest on the minor 7, on G minor in the A flat major song here. And so forth. And it's like there's no resting place in the melody. It's always moving forward and taking me along with it in a way that happens really very rarely. And this is, I just think, a wonderfully special piece.
It is. I don't think I could find it from her brother's piece. That's usually, it's, you know, it's very kind of, you can tell when it's end. Okay, that's end. And then now there's new phrase. And
yeah,
you know,
right.
But yeah. It is.
Right, she has the same last name as her brother,
right.
But she's a very, very different composer.
Different.
And the harmonic language is, I don't know, you kind of need like Riemannian theory or something to make mm-hmm. to analyze it.
Yeah.
Which usually you apply to music written about 40 years after this.
Yeah, very forward for her time. Great. Yeah. Any specific reason that you are learning this piece, or it's just for fun?
Oh gosh. Well, one way that I keep in touch with a lot of standard repertoire, shall we say, and discover new repertoire, which is often not standard, is that I teach music theory, and so I'm looking through repertoire all the time. Mm-hmm. I actually really love that about having a teaching position, mm-hmm. that it's an excuse to get out Lieder and read through the mm-hmm. accompaniment, even when I'm not preparing them with a singer. Mm-hmm. So I think I probably discovered this piece doing something like that. I was just thunderstruck by it. There is, the Chopin Opus 27, number 2, the D-flat major nocturne, right? It's so beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There's a, you know, the Rubinstein kind of archetypal recording of that piece, which is so special. I was teaching that piece for one reason or another, and I was using just the YouTube score following video so the students could follow it along easily. And I noticed that there was a YouTube comment under this piece that I think about all the time. It's so funny. It's so mysterious that we exist.
Oh, wow. That's the comment.
It's such a non sequitur, right? All the other comments are about, you know, how great Rubinstein is and all that kind of stuff.
Wow.
And then this one person, this anonymous YouTube user, somehow articulates what I was thinking but didn't know that I was thinking as I listened to it. So every once in a while, a piece of music comes along that says, that tells me or makes me think, you know, it's so mysterious that we exist.
Well, that's great. That's a great way to, describe the music of Chopin, maybe. Or, I don't know, a performance of playing of Rubinstein. I mean, since we're talking about Chopin Nocturne, and that, of course, we, once again, both of us love Chopin, and who wouldn't, really? And I'm, you know, particularly really happy about this new piece, Nocturne, your new piece, Nocturne.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, I was just saying that, you know, it's been front of the piece that says, you know, play like Chopin, you know, you'd play Chopin. And
Right. That's something I'd wanted to do for a while, was to really write a kind of Chopin homage consciously in a way that a lot of my other music isn't as apparent about. You know, this piece has been with me a long time, and I'm almost finished with the whole piece. The Nocturne is part of a series of lead sheet realizations, shall we call them, on the ballad Stella by Starlight.
Mm-hmm.
But realized in a way that disguises its origin, maybe borrows from it in some way, but in this case filters it through the lens of Chopin. So I was working on this piece. When did I start it? I don't know. Probably in the fall of like 2019 or something. I started it, but it was kind of on the back burner. And then I was really just getting into it around, you know, March of 2020,
mm-hmm.
and we all know what happened.
Yeah.
You were going to play at this beautiful, I imagine, festival in the Pyrenees in France. An outdoor concert under the stars at this festival in Blanc et Noir, and the idea of this ballad came into my head, you know, by Starlight. But then, when everything fell to pieces, I was kind of, I think, comforted by these repertoire that has comforted me all my life, these Chopin nocturnes. And that was kind of what I invested my time in right at the very beginning. Those first couple of weeks, when everybody thought this was just going to be gone in a few weeks, I started working on this nocturne, thinking that, okay, it will become part of this larger piece. And then, of course, the festival evaporated.
Right.
And I stopped working on the piece for at least a year and just had this orphaned Chopin nocturne, which you still have. And actually have only in the past maybe 4 or 5 months or so gone back to the piece and put it back together, and I'm almost finished with it. And I think that the nocturne, the Chopin-esque nocturne, will be the last in the cycle. I think there's going to be 10 of them. You know, the question of like lead sheets and why do these things go together? In some way, they've always kind of gone together in my mind, but I think it takes a little bit of background. You know, going back to my grandfather, just improvising at the piano, not doing it well, but making music up for his own enjoyment. When I was about a senior in college or so, I had this feeling like I was losing that part of music, that I was losing music as a hobby because it was becoming a profession.
Mm-hmm.
And when it becomes a profession, there's this onus sometimes to feel like you have to really be a professional, that it has to be, you know, it has to stand up to criticism or whatever. And so it becomes work that you love, but work nonetheless.
Mm-hmm.
And as a way of kind of reclaiming this other kind of music making, sitting at the piano and feeling around, I started reading lead sheets and getting interested in jazz and jazz harmony. And I had no idea how to do it. I really didn't. But I've done that ever since, and I've kind of figured out, you know, something about how to read a lead sheet now. And although at first these were very separate things, you know, reading jazz standards or whatever on a lead sheet and going to compose so-called serious music, they were very separate endeavors. But kind of unsurprisingly, they've come in much better alignment, I think, in the past few years. One thing that enterprise, I think, really reminded me of, and it took me a while to realize it, I think, but when I was reading these lead sheets, they brought joy to me. You know, they made me happy. And I started to question some things that I think, you know, as a student, as I was trying to make my music more and more complex and whatever, I started to question the disconnect between these things. Like, is this highly, is this dense gestural, you know, quasi-serial, whatever, is this bringing me joy in the same way that, you know, these Jerome Kern lead sheets are? And, you know, from there, I started listening to a lot of jazz music, to artists like Oscar Peterson, and eventually, you know, more recently, music by Fred Hirsch, and, you know, some more contemporary jazz artists. You know, it's brought about, I think, it's made me more honest, I think, in what I look for as a composer and what I really try to find. One of the things that really fascinates me about the jazz harmony and the lead sheet template is the kind of ambiguity of harmony and the richness of it that's contained in that ambiguity, which as a composer has always been something that I really like. Like, you know, for example, you can play any chromatic note in a dominant seventh chord in a jazz, and call it a jazz harmony, right? So here's, you know, C dominant seven. Here's with the D flat. D natural is the ninth. Here's the split ninth. Of course, the third. Here's, let's see, the suspended four, sharp 11, fifth, sharp 5, 13, of course back up to the seventh. And yeah, the B natural is tough because you already have the seventh in it, but if you're clever about it, you can fit that in too. Like, there's the B natural. Right. So, yeah, that's all 12 of them. The reason that those things sound like C dominant 7, or that they can reasonably be called C dominant 7, is because of the way that they're voiced. You know, this you could use as a colorful realization of C dominant 7 in the lead sheet. There's also, well, I'm going to get too ahead of myself here, this question of voicing. Now, those are all like root position. And there's a wonderfully ambiguous area between like when something is and is not a C dominant 7. So if I bring it down into this voicing here, let's see, you know. Doesn't really sound like C anymore. It's some kind of cluster that I could, I mean, you could still use it, but it's not C anymore. But like, how about this one? Maybe, it could be. Okay, if it goes to F minor, maybe you hear it as C. So it's so dependent on context, but there's never really, there's no answer to that question. And that's why it's so interesting.
Yeah, it's like you talk about this, you know, that ambiguity that's in the line drawings, the first book, first movement, that it's really depends on, you know, what you hear and who hears this music. It's like it can be anything, really. It's not really, you know, something that you define and give the label, like, oh yeah, this is like F major, or, you know, it's nothing like that.
Right. And what's so I find so rewarding about that kind of ambiguity is not that it can mean different things to different people, which is true, it can, but also that it can mean different things to the same person.
Oh, that's true.
That you can hear it in so many different ways at once. You realize that you're, you know, feeling different things and you know, reconcile them in some way.
Different years, different time, kind of thing. Yeah.
Well, and the other thing about about these chords that I find so interesting is the way in which tones really color each other, which I think jazz musicians are really, really kind of intuit. Like, if I play this, it sounds like, you know, maybe Bartok or something.
Right.
This is a C sharp, G sharp, and a C natural underneath it. You could use it, you know. But then if I add, let's see, I'll add this tritone to it here, and it becomes this. Like somehow this dissonance has been colored in it.
Yeah.
It's been transformed in some way.
Absolutely, yeah.
Right?
It's amazing. Can we hear the music that we talked about? Take this opportunity to listen to the Nocturne and line drawings, maybe?
Sure, yeah.
Okay, so here, line drawings, book one, movement one, line drawings, book two, movement three, and Nocturne, Stella by Starlight. Thank you. It's so nice to hear them again. It's
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
So the question of, like, you know, this harmony and how this relates to Chopin, you know, as you hear in that nocturne, I think Chopin, of all the composers of his time, I can really hear in his harmonic language this kind of searching quality, where you can almost, when you play it, you can kind of feel his hand searching around for the notes, like, you know, that opus 9 number 1, mm-hmm. the middle section, mm-hmm. you know, that one, mm-hmm. you have these open fifths in the left hand, mm-hmm. and then like you can feel how he searches for that, how that octave collapses in from here to here. Moves him in a mm-hmm. different direction. So there's this wonderful kind of improvisatory quality in his music, but it comes about because of the way that it's voiced. That's what's so special about his harmony, that the movement from D flat major here to an A7 in first inversion comes about because the D flat is spaced like this stack of fifths.
Yeah.
And that can happen to it. And it happens so seemingly effortlessly because he had such an incredible ear for voicing. And also in his music, I think you hear, this is why I think of his harmony as being jazz-like, or another reason why I think of it is because you can hear this really ambiguous distinction between what is a harmonic tone and what's an embellishment.
Hmm.
You know, so for instance, you hear this, and like that's as much the harmony, this chord, as what it so-called resolves to. And for that matter, the obbligato line in the middle is part of that too.
Mm-hmm. It's amazing. I mean, it's, you know, like you'd just think sometimes, oh yeah, that's just a figuration and just accompaniment to, and that's what a lot of people,
yeah, right.
you know, that's what a lot of people
right,
think
I know,
of
you're right.
the Chopin lesson. Oh yeah, you have this beautiful accompaniment in the left hand, and then you have this, you know, beautiful melody that's, leading the left hand, but yeah, that his figuration, I think that's really something unique. And
a lot of times the right hand is just bringing out a line that's already in the left hand.
That's true. Yeah,
you know, that there's this contrapuntal texture in mm-hmm. the that the right hand it's already
yeah.
there in the left
yeah.
hand. There's this wonderful counterpoint,
oh,
this
yeah.
voice leading
oh, yeah.
that is really what makes it so expressive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's also another thing about your music, I think, that I really love. That's the counterpoint and this transparency. I really enjoy that, playing the line drawings, the whole set, and of course we talked about it a little bit in the beginning about the movement 3 from the book 2. It was really one of my favorite movements, really. And
yeah, thank you. Yeah, mine too.
Yeah, so yeah, you know, also remind me of the concerto that I did years ago, the third movement, the slow movement from This Living Air. Also, it was just really beautiful counterpoint, and yeah.
Yeah, thank you. That third movement was the last one that I wrote in that concerto. And I had a lot of false starts on that third movement. And in a way, you know what I was talking about earlier about, you know, just kind of becoming more honest with myself after leaving graduate school, not to impugn my graduate school teachers or anything, who were wonderful. It's just, I think, something that naturally happens when you no longer think of yourself as a student. That movement in particular, I think, was a big step in that direction.
Hmm.
You know, the end of that movement, you know, most of it, there's this line. We started by talking about Fanny Mendelssohn, mm-hmm. and that line that never really lets go, mm-hmm. but just keeps going. Mm-hmm. And that is something that I don't think I knew Fanny Mendelssohn's Opus 6 at the time, but that was kind of something that I was going for in that third movement, a line that it's always moving and yet it's never really going anywhere, mm-hmm. Which is not true about the Mendelssohn, but I think it's kind of going for the same thing, a line that you're always kind of wondering where it's going to go next or something. And under that, there's this very diatonic, almost like faux bardone or something in the lower part of the piano that becomes kind of indistinct. And somehow I knew that, you know, as I mentioned, all these false starts in that piece, there was one thing that I picked up along the way, among all the false starts, was the very ending of the piece. It goes... how does it go? I think it's that. I think that's it, something like that. I remember just really liking that and saying to myself, all right, whatever happens in the piece, it's going to end like that. Mm. but the interesting thing is that kind of resolves down to this big open B in fifths. The rest of the piece is very much not in that kind of tonality. Mm-hmm. It's all in this, you know, A mixolydian or something like that. Or at least the full baronne stuff is, the right hand is, it has the F sharp in it, and there's a kind of distance between them because of that gap in the modes. So then there's this, I you know, had gone through a lot of that third movement knowing that it was going to end this way, and so that kind of brought about this coda in the piece, which I think is my favorite part in the whole concerto, where everything just slips down by a half step into this B open fifth that's kind of separated in time. Sometimes I think, you know, as a composer, you think that the end of the piece needs to summarize the piece or something, that it needs to be like the final piece of the puzzle. But in this case, and in many cases, a lot of endings that I really like have nothing to do with anything that came before it. It's a surprise, and somehow it works. That's always a real joy when you find that.
Great. You know, I was today that you, what we talked little bit before about this show, and you sent me the recording of Start Like Start, the ensemble piece with piano, and that also reminds me of the concerto, this living air, that, you know, that kind of dancey movement, kind of light, there's width and all that. It reminds me of this, you know, like first movement or second movement of this living air.
Yeah, I sent you that piece. I'm really fond of it, because it's, you know, what I said earlier about Giocondo and the question of which piano. Mm-hmm. The piano in that piece is written almost entirely on one staff, and it's basically one note at a time. Mm-hmm. Right? It's very easy for the piano to barge its way into a chamber piece. You know, like if you put the pedal down on the piano, then the pedal is down, and it doesn't matter what everybody else is doing on it, because the pedal is down. That takes the affect of the piece and holds mm-hmm. it hostage. Mm-hmm. You know, like true. Of course, you can do great things over a big cloud of sound with a piano pedal down, but it really asserts itself in the texture. So I really wanted to make the piano kind of an equal player in the ensemble there. And I think it's kind of like you hear there's the piano and the percussion is almost only xylophone with a couple of other little things that both have this hard edge to them. And then the woodwinds kind of round out the rest of the sound. Or to put it the other way, you have the woodwinds and then the piano edges them. So it gives it a kind of punch without ever really taking over the texture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's also, you know, there's that transparency, I think. And, you know, you can hear the different voices and lines and, you know, I always thought your music reminds me of also like Baroque music, you know, it's dancey, kind of, there's this dance quality. Also there is that kind of crisp sound, you know, it's not like heavy and I mean, it's, you know, certainly different from like, for example, like Brahms, for example, or, you know, and I think that's also why, why we collaborated for, you know, a long time. And I like your music a lot. And, you know, I think my playing also kind of, it's more in that style, more in that style of playing.
Thank you. Well, I will send you this piece I'm working on very soon, as I mentioned. Right. The Nocturne is the last part of it. But it begins with just a realization of Stella by Starlight, and then goes from there into this kind of four-voice texture, but it's kind of like, you know, oh, I don't know, like an obbligato line or something that's being passed around the texture. Reminds me a little of that Chopin that I was just playing. That one. I attempted to record the very beginning of the piece. And you can hear a little bit of that movement at the end of it. But I was thinking as I was writing that you will play that beautifully. Because you'll bring out those lines. You'll bring out the kind of clarity of the texture and hear more than just the kind of sum of the notes that are on the page. You hear like these complementary lines and bring them out individually. So I'm really looking forward to hearing what you do with that.
I'm looking forward to receiving the piece and playing. So yeah, great. Maybe we can listen to your ensemble piece, Start Like Start.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah. So here is A Start Like Start by John Liberatore. Thank you. Great. I want to always ask, I have asked my guests in this show always that if you have any advice for young pianists who have not played any new music, any music by living composers, if you have any suggestion, any insights you want to share?
To pianists who've not played music of living composers. There is such an incredible wealth of new music being made. I think that sometimes, you know, the music history sequence only gets up to about 1975 or so. And so people go through a conservatory and think that new music still sounds like, you know, Donald Martino or Milton mm-hmm. Babbitt or something. Mm-hmm. And although, yeah, there's some great music by those composers and also in the vein of those composers, that's certainly not the only thing that's out there. And there's just an incredible amount of music that really articulates something about, you know, being an artist today that's really vital. I think that honestly the time has passed where you can strike out in the world as a pianist playing, you know, recitals of a Baroque piece, a classical sonata, and a big romantic piece, and doing that better than everybody else. I think it's really important for any artist, a performer or a composer, to find a way of speaking, something that we have to say and that brings us a kind of joy that we want to share with other people, but that's ours. And I think one of the ways to do that is to work with, you know, music that's being written now. I'm sure that you could testify that working with composers has created all kinds of opportunity and collaboration and enrichment for you. But I guess what goes along with that is that there's something I think about a lot. You know why we started working together? One of the first pieces that kind of brought about our collaboration over the years was because I volunteered to work sound for John Graham's viola recital at the Memorial Art Gallery. And I volunteered, it was three nights and I did all three nights. So John was very grateful and he, you know, we got to talking and he eventually asked me to write him a piece, which I did. And I used that piece as an application piece. I went to Tanglewood that summer because he'd recorded this incredible recording of that piece. And while I was there, I wrote a tiny little 2-minute piece for viola and violin, and I gave it to Sini Virtanen, the violinist, and she gave it to her duo partner, which was you, she told you about it, I guess.
Yeah.
And then the two of you asked me to write that violin and piano piece, which I wrote, and then wrote many others, and you've taken my music all around the world and put it out on three CDs. You know, of course, I'm very grateful for all of that. But it's because of this one, like, you know, because I worked sound at John Graham's viola recital. If I hadn't done that, none of that would have happened. And if only you could be, if only you knew, like, which opportunities are going to manifest in that way, mm-hmm. then you would only do those. But of course, you don't know. Like, I also wrote pieces for people who left the profession or whatever, or people that seemed really interested in my music and then, you know, never played the piece again or whatever. You don't know when these opportunities for collaboration come up, where they're going to lead. And you have to cast a wide net and see what takes you along. So I think as a performer, one of the ways to do that is to work with other artists. And if you're a solo pianist, then opportunities for that are, you know, they may be a little bit more rare than if you're a you know, if you play chamber music or something. So working with living composers is a way into this bigger world of people who are out there making music and being entrepreneurial and making concerts happen.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much. And it was great to talk to you.
Yeah, you too. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. So, yeah. Support us by donating. You can go to our website, www.contemporaryartmusicproject.org, and simply click the donate button. Help us so we can continue our podcast, concerts, projects, and festivals. Thank you for listening. I will see you next time with Piano Music.